Over 60,000 U.S. troops are still in Afghanistan. What hurdles does the U.S. face as that international military operation winds down? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest in the first half hour is National Security Analyst Brian Katulis of the Center for American Progress. Katulis is visiting Iowa. He'll also comment on Iraq, 10 years after the start of that war. Then Professor Todd Gitlin of the Columbia School of Journalism, who's also visiting Iowa, he'll share how the biggest stories of the last decade, including events leading to the Iraq War, were missed or misreported by the mainstream news media. First, this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this first half hour is Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. His work focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He's in Iowa and will be giving presentations on the Middle East in the next 2 days. Today, March 26th, before the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations, that will be given this evening at 5:30 at the Wakanda Club, and tomorrow, March 27th at Drake University, 7:30 in the evening, the start time for that one. Brian Katulis in our Des Moines studio. Welcome back to our program, Brian.
Great to be with you, Ben.
I want to talk about, so many things to talk about in your area of specialty: Afghanistan, Iraq, 10 years after the start of the war, the civil war in Syria, Iran's role in all of this, really tied together. Have you give us some insights? Let's start. Let's dive in with Afghanistan. About 100,000 troops still in Afghanistan, including some 66,000 from the U.S. A grim tally for us in Iowa. To date, 92 Iowa service members have been killed in Afghanistan and Iraq since the beginning of the Iraq War a decade ago, according to the Des Moines Register. And most recently, a 27-year-old Staff Sergeant Stephen Blass of Esterville, we heard in our news. He died in a helicopter crash a few days ago, March 11th, in Afghanistan. The bigger picture, yesterday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Afghan President Hamid Karzai made a show of unity. Kerry in Afghanistan for an unannounced visit. So this comes on the heels of an unannounced visit to Iraq few days earlier before that. And the visit, though, to Afghanistan coming shortly after the U.S. military ceded control of its last detention facility in Afghanistan. Kerry said he and Karzai were, quote, on the same page when it comes to peace talks with the Taliban. Tell us, what was the goal of Kerry's mission in Afghanistan?
I think the goal of Kerry's mission was to strengthen the political and diplomatic components of the transition. The U.S. is aiming to remove most of its troops by the end of 2014. So there's a security transition where we're handing over lead responsibility to the Afghan security forces. But what Secretary Kerry was doing was making sure that everything else that needs to be done to help Afghanistan have a government that functions, to make sure that it's preparing for its national elections next year, and to make sure that all of these other institutional components, that we have at least some decent foundation for the Afghans to work with beyond an army and a police. And I think this is just the start of what will be intense diplomatic efforts to help Afghans move forward on their political process, both in terms of reaching out to the Taliban and then also preparing for their national elections next year.
You mentioned the Taliban. It had been reported before this visit that Hamid Karzai had infuriated U.S. officials by accusing Washington of colluding with Taliban insurgents to keep Afghanistan weak. It doesn't quite square with what I think a lot of people think of the relationship between the U.S. and the Taliban. Why would the U.S. do that, and what do you make of this charge?
I make it – it's quite puzzling. It makes me scratch my head. And a lot of people in Washington, quite frankly, are wondering yet again, is Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, a reliable ally? I think part of the reason why he says this is he tries to appeal to certain domestic constituencies he has. He wants to demonstrate that he's not just a pawn of the United States and NATO. And he does this oftentimes in language that I think hurts his country's cause. As you recall, you know, when President Obama gave his State of the Union address earlier this year, one of the biggest applause lines from both Republicans and Democrats Democrats was he's ending the war in Afghanistan. So our patience in the United States has worn quite thin, understandably so. And the statements by Karzai, which aim to play to his own domestic constituencies to say that, look, I'm standing up to the U.S., and sometimes he uses weird conspiracy theories like this, it doesn't play very well here. And I think what Secretary Kerry was trying to do was to put the relationship back on an even keel and say, look, you know, we're not going behind your back in trying to engage the Taliban, and let's stay on the same page here. It's in your interest and it's in our interest.
Mm-hmm. So give us an idea of what is the relationship, the U.S. relationship with the Taliban, the level of engagement with the Taliban by the U.S., and how the Karzai government then it fits in.
There was an attempt in 2011 by then the lead U.S. diplomat Mark Grossman, who had replaced Richard Holbrooke when he passed away, to meet with elements of the Taliban. And there were reported meetings, some of which were facilitated by the government of Pakistan and some individuals there. Those talks didn't go very far, in part because it's not widely discussed, but there is a U.S. Troop member who's held by the Taliban, has been held for several years now. And part of the deal and the deal breaker was that elements of the Taliban wanted releases of prisoners from Guantanamo Bay in exchange for this prisoner. So that's one complication. Another complication is just the venue. Where would these talks happen? Who's included in it? So, you know, what we've had so far are just very early attempts at diplomacy, which for the last year or so have not really gone anywhere, in part because of the stalemate over the prisoner exchange.
Mm-hmm. When was the tipping point at which we decided not to have as a goal to defeat the Taliban and instead negotiate with them?
When, you know, there was a realization when Afghanistan's security situation really started turning south in 2006, 2007, in part because of the lack of attention, because of we'd shifted our focus to Iraq and the civil war in Iraq there. There was a recognition by military U.S. military commanders by 2007 and leading into 2008, 2009, that even though we were adding more troops, U.S. troops were being sent to Afghanistan, that you needed a political settlement and that there were ways to pick off some elements of the Taliban. Some would never reconcile. Some would never break with al-Qaeda. But there were clear indications, and I think there have been some small steps to include them in the political process. And I think ultimately it's not one or the other. I think there's still a concerted military campaign. The U.S. troops are active in that, NATO forces, and then more importantly these days, the Afghan troops. But, you know, I think we need to learn to both talk and fight at the same time and try to figure out who really is interested in talking and reconciling in the long run.
My guest this half hour, Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, visiting Iowa this week. And if you'd like to join our conversation with your questions about, well, we're talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria will fit in here, Iran as well. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Now, Kerry, Secretary of State's Kerry's visit to Afghanistan comes after shortly after the U.S. has ceded the control of its last detention facility in Afghanistan. What is the significance of that?
Well, the significance of it is to try to give a boost to Afghan sovereignty. And, you know, almost all of the prisoners were transferred. A handful still remain in U.S. custody because of their particular security threat that they pose. So, you know, the significance here is that for the last few years, Hamid Karzai, the president, has been saying, I want more control over my own country. And I think, though symbolic, I think it's an important step forward. We should all watch, though, to see how well these detention facilities are maintained. There have been previous incidences in Kandahar, which is the second largest city in mm-hmm. southern Afghanistan, where there have been major prison breaks after they've been transferred to Afghan control. So I think there's going to be a very close monitoring of how this all goes.
Mm-hmm. The Obama administration pressing ahead with its plans to, I guess, hand off security responsibility to Afghan forces in a wider sense to end NATO's combat mission by the end of next year, all according to plan?
The security transition on paper is going according to plan. But I think the weakest elements, and this is why I think Secretary Kerry was out there, the weakest elements are the political and the economic components. Afghanistan still is a country that's heavily dependent on foreign assistance. It would not the government would not continue to survive if the U.S. and other allies did not provide support. And then on the political component, I think it's very important that we try to help the Afghans get a more cohesive political system between now and their national elections a year from now. Because essentially everything could be for naught if there is not more agreement among Afghan political leaders. All of the efforts to build an army and all of the efforts to build the police, all of these tools of national power could be turned against each other in a civil war if there isn't more progress on a political compact and moving forward and discussing who's going to come after President Karzai.
Well, after so long, the longest war in U.S. history, we're still hanging in the balance then.
We are, and it's amazing after more than a decade that things are so precarious now. But I think it's in part because we've had a strategy that was so heavily focused on what the military does and that we need to do more to focus on what our diplomats do.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, when we talk about Afghanistan, we have to talk about Pakistan. What is the situation there now and the challenges as Pakistan moves into the future?
Well, it's interesting. I saw our U.S. ambassador to Pakistan yesterday in Washington, and he was painting a picture of trying to put the U.S. relationship with Pakistan on a much more even keel. We've had a couple of bad years, especially after the bin Laden raid and the fact that Osama bin Laden was found in a town not far from the capital city of Islamabad, and a lot of incidents there. So I think the main thing that Pakistan is focused on is its own internal challenges right now. They have an election coming up later this spring, and actually it'll be a historic election if it moves forward. Seems like it's going to move forward. It'll be the first time in the country's history where the military has not intervened and prevented a civilian government having to transfer power through elections. But Pakistan's, I think, biggest problem is the fact that it's a country of more than 180 million people that is having problems of basic governance and meeting the needs of its citizens, from water delivery to basic jobs and other things. So they've got a huge amount of problems that'll keep them internally focused these days.
Brian Katulis, let's pivot to another part of the Middle East that you concern yourself with, Iraq. We've marked 10 years since the start of that war in the spring of 2003. I wonder, this is a big question, but I wonder if you can give us a quick survey of how that conflict evolved in the past 10 years and where we are now.
Well, we went in on bad information. And I think with multiple objectives to try not only to get rid of Saddam Hussein but to see if he had weapons of mass destruction. He did not. We went in with the initial idea of having a light footprint and leaving pretty quickly. We didn't. We stayed for a long period of time.
But that military invasion was a success militarily.
From the U.S. standpoint, I think the initial, you know, the first couple of weeks, yes.
The march to Baghdad.
Yeah, the march to Baghdad. But then there were several key mistakes made in those first early months. We disbanded the military.
Why did that matter?
Because this is one of the few national institutions that kept the country together, provided security for the country, and that decision was disastrous. It actually led to sort of the decline of law and order and then helped precipitate a civil war that was very vicious, that killed more than 100,000 people. And then we found ourselves stuck there in the middle of a civil war. It got really bad in 2006. In 2007, we sent a small amount of troops as part of a surge. But essentially, what we saw in Iraq was one group winning. The Shia group largely defeated the Sunnis, and the Kurds became increasingly autonomous. So right now, you know, more than 10 years later, Iraq is still bitterly divided. It's actually as violent, if not more violent, than Afghanistan, and it's got a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. The Shia in control in Iraq, which dovetails into the news that we've been hearing this last week. Days ago, Secretary of State John Kerry again made this unannounced visit to Baghdad, the first by a U.S. Secretary of State since 2009. He pushed Iraq not to allow overflights from Iran to Syria flying over Iraq, and said the U.S. position, they believe they're carrying weapons, fighters, to help prop up the Syrian regime. Now, is it because the Shias are allied with the Shias in Iran that this happens?
There are close ties between the current leadership and the Iraqi government, which is Shia-led, and the leaders in Tehran. I wouldn't say at a popular level, and when I was in Iraq in 2003 and 2004, when you talk to ordinary Shia, there's not a lot of love for Iran, because Iraq and Iran in the 1980s had a long war that went on for 8 years, and people remember that. So it's not pure sort of blind allegiance to Iran at a popular level, but this government, the Maliki government, the prime minister of Iraq, is much more in Iran's orbit, and it shouldn't surprise people.
Why, though, this very public pronouncement after a meeting with al-Maliki? Why make it big in the press internationally to say that this should not be happening?
Because I think what Secretary Kerry and the Obama administration has been trying to do is create divisions between Baghdad and Tehran on this. Syria is quite clearly slipping more deeply into a civil war, and any side that's aiding and abetting the Assad regime is helping Iran. And that's, I think, the argument here is that the Iraqi government should not be doing this. It's not in U.S. interests. It's also in the long term, not I think, in Iraq's interests.
Mm-hmm. Explain Iran's interests and goals in the region, especially in regards to Syria.
Well, it's complicated because I think Iran has tried to project power in many ways since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. And it has sought allies like the Shia terrorist group Hezbollah in Lebanon as one key means to have influence throughout the Middle East. In places like Bahrain, there are accusations that it supports the Shia majority there who are protesting against the king there. So it uses not only support for terrorist networks, but also it uses charity networks, religious networks in Iraq, in Lebanon, and in places like Syria to get influence with the leadership there. So it's really, I think, trying and I think in the last couple of years Iran has seen its power wane in the Middle East. So I think it's a bit more desperate these days as it faces increasing international isolation over its nuclear program.
Mm-hmm. Back to Iraq as a partner, Kerry said in this latest visit that U.S. lawmakers and the American people are, quote, increasingly watching what Iraq is doing and wondering how it is a partner. What is your sense of how Iraq is and will be as a partner to the U.S.?
You know, a lot of Americans are asking after $1.7 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money, what did we get out of this? And I mean, it's my assessment, it's a net negative for U.S. interests. It still is to this day, even though things are a little bit better in Iraq. I think ultimately Iraq and its leaders are going to try to carve out its own independent path. It'll be slightly more in the orbit of Iran as it is today than we'd like it to be. But this is sort of the story of the Middle East today, is that this complicated multipolar competition for power, and that each individual country is trying to assert its own interests. And it's more shades of gray as opposed to Shia versus Sunni or black versus white here. And mm-hmm. I think Iraq will try to carve out its own national path.
In earlier eras, take the Cold War, for example, certainly misperceptions in hindsight about what we were facing in the Cold War. Would you say there are misperceptions by certain groups in Washington that concern the Middle East right now, the area we've been talking about?
Oh, well, there's a lot. I mean, I just talked about this in terms of the Shia-Sunni divide, which is a major division in the religion of Islam, but it's also manifests itself in this political divide. And I think that tends to oversimplify what's going on in the region right now. There's also, I think, sometimes people talk about the divisions between monarchies, you know, countries led by kings versus republics in the region. And I think the biggest thing that's going on right now in the Middle East is this historic transformation where people, the power of the people, are matter a lot more than it did in previous decades. And it's creating complicated political dynamics in each of these countries. Sometimes it's violent, sometimes it's not. Places like Egypt, largely mostly nonviolent, but still a big struggle for what are these countries and what do they stand for.
Mm-hmm. Power of the people, does that equate with democracy as we know it?
No. And we should be clear about this. And in some cases, in some of the early transitions, like Egypt, have raised more questions about whether there's going to be true respect for pluralism, respect for the full range of rights that come associated with democracy. So I think, you know, the labels that are often used, Arab Spring or Arab Awakening, to describe what's going on here, are insufficient to talk about what's going on, because these are very incomplete processes that I think are going to take years. It's not going to be like what we saw in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall, in part because of the demographics of the region. You got 60% of the region under the age of 25. So if you think the last 2 years have been complicated, it's only going to get even worse.
Mm. President Obama in office for the next 4 years in his second administration. I wonder, how would you contrast his approach in the Middle East? He's picked up where George W. Bush left off, I mean, time-wise. I want you to contrast, though, his approach to the areas we've been talking about today with that of George W. Bush.
Well, here's maybe an oversimplification, but I think President Bush was like the quarterback who tried to throw several Hail Mary passes down the field, and a lot of those passes actually ended up resulting in a loss of yardage for the U.S., that we saw setbacks and some dangerous situations emerge. I think President Obama has been his main thrust has been ending the war in Iraq and now Afghanistan, but then trying to more pragmatically move the ball up the field with 1 yard, 2 yard runs. The question in the region now is the U.S. actually a leader? Are we a factor? Because, I mean, so much, and I was just in the region 2 weeks ago, so much of the dialogue now is, what about your problems at home and your budget debate and the fights that the president's having with Congress? That's having a real impact on our ability to be perceived as a leader. If we can't take care of our own issues and problems, people are wondering why, you know, what can we do for the region?
Mm-hmm. We've been talking a lot about the failures of U.S. policy and security interests in these areas in the last few minutes. I wonder, what do you point to as the biggest successes when we talk about the last decade or two in the area?
Well, there aren't any sort of great big successes we can talk about because I think a lot of – when you look at sort of the ledgers I talked about on Iraq of what we've spent and what we've lost in terms of treasure and blood, the returns have been pretty low. But I think there is no other leader in the world that is willing to provide the security and the guarantee of security throughout the region. And I think that, you know, that's one thing. I think the other thing is when I go to places like the Palestinian Authority and you see what we've invested in the Palestinian Authority there, there is a chance for good governance and decency there. And I think we should continue to make those investments.
Mm-hmm. President Obama, the week before last, his first visit as president to Israel, what did he accomplish?
I think he set a new tone with the Israeli public and sent a signal that in a time of change in the Middle East, as we've been talking about in this segment, we need reliable allies, people that we can lean on. And I think he sent that message clearly in Israel. He sent that to the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. And then in Jordan, which is a monarchy that has been so close to U.S. ties for decades, I think they needed this show of support. They're facing a lot of pressure from the Syrian civil war, from the tension still in Iraq. And I think he sent this message of, we're going to stand by you, Israel, Jordanians and Palestinians, but you've got to work with us.
And Benjamin Netanyahu seemed to have reciprocated.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the first 4 years, the first term of the Obama administration, there was a lot of political intrigue and suspicions that Netanyahu was supporting mm-hmm. Mitt Romney and other things. And I think so far, so good. They've sort of smoothed that over.
Brian Katulis, so much to talk about. We've had a very short time, but thank you for the quick overview on your area of expertise. Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. You'll be speaking today before the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations at the Wakanda Club, 5:30 in the evening tomorrow, March 27th at Drake University at 7:30. Brian, always good to have you on the program. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll continue our discussion to some extent to talk about Iraq, but we'll talk about how the biggest stories of the last decade, including events leading to the Iraq War, were missed or misreported by the mainstream news media. After a short break, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Over the noon hour, I'm Ben Kiefer. Many of the biggest stories of the past decade or two, including events leading to the Iraq War, were missed or misreported by the mainstream news media. That will be one of the focuses of my next guest on his upcoming visit to Iowa. Todd Gitlin is a professor and doctoral program chair at the Columbia School of Journalism. He will be speaking Thursday, April 4th at the University of Iowa campus to talk about journalism's failings and continued necessity. He joins us by phone for the rest of this hour. Professor Gitlin, welcome.
Thank you.
Since last half hour, you weren't with us, but we discussed with a national security policy expert Iraq, the Middle East, and I see that there's some overlap there. So if we could, let's start there. Since we discussed Iraq in the last half hour, how did the mainstream journalism, the news media, fail us in the run-up to that war?
Well, they were credulous toward government claims about the presence of so-called weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and the putative relation between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. They gave the benefit of the doubt. They leaned over backward to give the benefit of the doubt to administration officials who were bending the facts. When there were administration officials who were doubting it, even in private, but known to some journalists, as in the CIA, they didn't get a hearing. When Secretary of State Powell spoke before the UN and left a lot of holes in his presentation, the news media were more impressed by His Majesty than by the holes. Many distortions, which have been amply demonstrated and, in fact, copped to by our two principal sources of foreign news, the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm. So what might, in particular, what might the Washington, the New York Times, Washington Post have done that they didn't do in particular?
Well, they should have taken their own reporters seriously. I'm thinking here specifically of the Washington Post, Walter, whose name escapes me at the moment, their long-term defense correspondent, who actually did have sources who were expressing the doubt. Walter Pincus is his name. They were full of doubt about the Bush claim and Cheney claim, but his stuff was dumped in the back pages. They should have the editors should have beaten their breasts in abject apology. They should have actually taken the New York Times should not have given Judy Miller her head, should not have let her make highly dubious claims about, for example, the meaning of some aluminum tubes that had been intercepted. I mean, you don't want to go into the details about this.
But yeah,
what they should have done is appreciated that the country was still in a sort of panic. And the political class was in a panic with them after September 11th, and that there was therefore a propensity to be gullible, to take at face value claims made by an administration that had demonstrated its disrespect for truth and its propagandistic commitments amply during the period it was in office, and in fact even before it came to office during the long election of 2000. I think they were in the process of living down their somewhat undeserved reputation for having undermined the sanctity of the war in Vietnam. And I think in general that period, that golden period, roughly 1955 to 75, was exceptional. Journalists, I think, were quite uncomfortable being pegged by political leaders and others as having as being critics, and they were retreating into a sort of soft, fuzzy relationship with power.
Mm-hmm. Based on what you just said, we remember that. I'm glad you said what you just said, because the context here can be forgotten in the 10 years plus that we've had to reflect on how the Iraq War started. If journalists had, the Washington Post, the New York Times, those two leaders had done a better job, would it have even made a difference in this sort of tidal wave? As I remember it, it was a march to war with very little chance for resistance.
Well, I think the Bush people were hell-bent on war. I think that is correct. Public opinion was not so hell-bent on war. An interesting book by the former research director of the Gallup poll that came out a few years ago analyzing the data, the public opinion data, and showing that while it's true that there was a preponderance of opinion that supported going to war, it was a good deal of it was soft. About half of it was firm, were Bush diehards. But another half were ambivalent, so that if there had been some hesitation expressed within the administration and if the news media had been more apt, then I think the public would have been quicker to be disabused of the war and would not have been so enthusiastic for openers.
Mm-hmm. Can we blame, or blame in part the bad economy, the terrible economic times specifically encountered by the news media at that time, also the business upheaval twinned with that caused by the digital revolution, trying to find this new business model?
In a word, no. It would have taken no more personnel to do serious reporting. I mean, there were news organizations that did get Iraq right. The McClatchy, it was then the Knight Ridder News Bureau, was extremely good. Newsweek had a number of things quite right, righter than the New York Times or the networks which follow the New York Times. It's no more expensive to be skeptical about Bush administration claims than to be credulous.
But it's harder to do with fewer personnel or a smaller budget.
No, I think in this case the equivalent number of personnel could have done a better job if they were wiser about who the Bush administration was and what the reality of the Middle East was.
Mm-hmm. Given the lessons learned, any reason to believe mainstream news media would do any better job today?
There's a lot of breastfeeding about how they'll do better today. Is there any reason? Yeah, I mean, one hopes. I mean, there was a period after the Vietnam War when the news media were more skeptical about American ventures overseas. How long? For maybe 10 years.
And the American public, the consumers, were more open to that skepticism.
This is also true. Yes, this is certainly true.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some of the other examples I think you point to in terms of the failings of the mainstream news media. You say the tech bubble. What happened there? We came and had this big crash in 2000, right?
99 and 2000, yeah.
Uh-huh. So walk us through that and tell us about the failings of mainstream media there.
Well, this is actually a smaller version of the more consequential failing during the housing boom and the derivative metastasis of the next few years. The news media were giddy with anticipation of a new order, apparently not only a new economic order, but a new sort of metaphysical order, so that companies that were making no money, were losing money on every purchase, were somehow taken seriously as pointing the way toward a new economy. There was all this new economy talk. And by the way, a related credulity was the spreading by the news media of the notion that the Y2K phenomenon would collapse either the American economy or the entire world economy. There was credulity about the magic that was held to be implicit in new gadgetry, new electronics.
That if we had a certain size portfolio, we could basically quit our jobs and get, 30% return every year.
And we could eat air.
So what might that? Have we learned lessons there? Do you see anything changing there, or will that just cycle back on us in a few years? Possibly.
It's not so much the tech bubble. Let's talk for a moment about the lionizing of the titans of finance. In the aftermath of the collapse in 2007-2008. I think the big bankers are not quite as worshipped. But there's still an inability or unwillingness to cover issues of regulation and deregulation with the intensity and extent that they require. There are some valuable exceptions. There are more exceptions than there were before 2007. But I think you'd be hard pressed to turn on CNBC or or any of the other television financial enterprises, let alone to find in the pages of the Wall Street Journal consideration to the line of argument promoted by Paul Volcker and Elizabeth Warren and a lot of other serious people, to the effect that the system wasn't fixed, there's even an argument that it's not fixable, and it's not my place to take a position on that. But in any case, the anatomy of what went wrong, the anatomy of the mortgage-based security fiasco, the anatomy of global finance, the anatomy of rapid trading, the anatomy of the eruption of the too big to fail banks, the failure to anticipate, and by the way, which was not, there were people who anticipated, but the major news media failed to anticipate what would happen if you blurred the line between commercial and mortgage banks. No, I'm not terribly confident that they're up to the job. And by the way, this is not just a declamation of malfeasance. I think these things are very hard to understand. That world is extremely tangled, and I don't know that all the bankers understand it. So, one issue to talk about straightforwardly with the American people is this a sensible financial system? Is this a system that is conducive to growth, or is a system conducive to self-aggrandizement and self-dealing?
Do you hear that question being asked at all?
Not at all.
Mm. Do you point the finger at more at certain news media organizations than others?
With respect to the bubble of...
Failings in general. Do certain areas do better than others, or are they... less bad.
I don't know. I mean, the New York Times has some financial writers who I think are more reliable, more savvy, more profound than others. There's a writer named Jesse Eisinger who writes for ProPublica and has his pieces picked up at the New York Times, who's very savvy about banks in particular. Floyd Norris and Gretchen Mortensen are, in general, ahead of the curve. And I think by the same token, when I pick up USA Today in an airport, in a hotel or something, I don't see much sign at all that anybody there is sort of interested in doing anything much more than sort of either crowing about how the market went up yesterday or muttering about how it went down and nobody understands why, when it's not the day-to-day perturbations of the market that matter at all. It's a question of what to say. Let's take another example of failing. How many times have we heard in the last couple of months that there's a deficit crisis?
That's a complete focus of our politics the last half year, for sure, if not longer.
And it's a fake. There is no deficit crisis. There is no deficit crisis. There is a deficit. It is not as large as it's been as a percentage of GDP at other times. It can be remedied with social spending, with stimulus to create jobs. It is, but the country has at least superficially been sold on the idea that there's a fiscal crisis, a deficit crisis, by the Republican Party and by certain wealthy promoters like Pete Peterson, the former Secretary of Commerce, who spent billions to panic the country into this. So, thus, somebody like Paul Ryan, who's arithmetically impaired. Came to be seen as a wise man and was within a hair of being elected Vice President of the United States for a budget fencing with an invisible enemy.
Professor Todd Gitlin is a doctoral program chair at the Columbia School of Journalism. He's with us for this half hour. He'll be speaking April 4th on the University of Iowa campus. A moment ago, Professor Gitlin, you were talking about various news organizations. I can't ignore the question of what you think, how you think public radio and TV fit into the mix for scrutiny.
To tell you the truth, I'm not listening to that much of either. But let me say something about NPR. I much enjoy listening to Marketplace, but I don't look to it for the serious debates that we need about, for example, why we have so much unemployment and why we have low growth, why we have low productivity, really the core questions that a democracy should be facing.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps it's useful for you to remind us, go really to the basic level here, since, of course, in our political discussion, we talk a lot about the Constitution, and we should. Remind us how a free press is supposed to work in our democracy and why a well-functioning, healthy journalism field is important for us.
Well, the theory is that the public can regulate itself, can regulate its affairs, I should say, when it's in possession of the necessary information. I think there's even a larger ideal that was stated by our great philosopher of news, Walter Lippmann, writing in 1922. The function of the journalism of truth is to bring to light the hidden facts, to set them into relation with each other, and make a picture of reality on which men can act. A picture of reality on which men can act. So the theory is not simply that you should say things that are factually true. The idea is that you should clarify what's at stake, not to dragoon people into taking one position or another, but that you should state the stakes. You should articulate what is at stake. And, the principle, I think the principle, if taken seriously, tells us that it is a public responsibility to see that we have a news system which is commensurate with the need for that democratic self-governance. And what that means is, at a time like this, when the economic bottom is falling out of the system of financing that the news has enjoyed for the last century and a half, I think that it's a responsibility of the public, of the public entities, namely governments, to sustain journalism. And I realize that sort of frightens a lot of people. But I don't see any other way in which the news, which we need to be a democratic society, is going to be financed. Obviously, advertising has fallen through the floor. Mm-hmm. Public is unplugging from news. So I don't know what Plan D is.
Do you see it as dark as it seemed to be a couple years ago? Still, don't we have some hopeful signs in this new emerging digital age, a business model for news?
I don't see it.
These subscribers paying for content not working?
That works for the New York Times and it works here and there. I don't think it's adequate. I don't think it can deliver the goods in the long run. You know, we get all scared about government subsidy, but our entire new system would have been impossible without a very early and fundamental news subsidy, which is something that sinister institution called the post office. If the U.S. government had not subsidized the post office, we could not have developed the modern news system. It was, you'll recall, one of the very first things they did. The ability of newspapers and magazines to mail at special subsidized rates, which they still retain, was an underpinning to their financing. So, we have a primitive notion in America that where you have government support, you have tyranny. I noticed the first item on your news broadcast was about 52 bridges in the state that are found insufficient. And I suppose most people would like to see those bridges fixed. I don't imagine that any private enterpriser is going to come out to fix them. I imagine that if they're going to be fixed, they're going to be fixed by government, which means by taxes. So we do rely on the government to do that for bridges. Don't we need to rely on some properly policed, properly administered government aid to keep up our intellectual bridge?
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left. Let me give you this hypothetical, Todd Gitlin. I am a young person interested in becoming a journalist. Perhaps a son. Let's make it very close to you. What advice do you give me?
Great. Go to it. Learn a lot. Learn about not just about how to dot your I's and cross your T's, but learn as much as you can about how the world works, and be prepared for an interesting life of improvising, doing journalism where you can, being paid where you can, not expecting the sort of career that used to be far more possible, namely you go to work in a small town, you establish yourself a few years, you go to a mid-city, then you go to a big city, and so on. Assume that journalism is going to be something for adventuresome people with a fair amount of tolerance for ambiguity and uncertainty, and go get them.
Mm. And so you wouldn't dissuade him or her. You would say,
not at all.
Go ahead. You can make an existence, and you can have fun doing it.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, at my own, I'm at the Columbia Journalism School. Students are flocking in here. I mean, applications are way up in recent years, and that's partly a function of the bad economy. But it actually is encouraging to me. More of the graduates of this journalism school are getting jobs, actually, than has been true since they started keeping figures. I don't quite understand how that can be true, but that's what our statistical people say.
Todd Gitlin, thank you very much. Of Columbia School of Journalism, we appreciate your conversation this afternoon.
I appreciate it from your end, too.
All right. Todd Gitlin will be speaking April 4th at the University of Iowa campus. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. You can contact us anytime. We'd love to hear from you. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. Tomorrow on this program, what if our political discussions are biological? We'll answer that question tomorrow on Politics Day. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.